But I'd like to talk now about the greatest drug problem that we have in America today. Now, a lot of people don't call alcoholism a drug. It's much more of a drug than LSD, pot, I don't care what you call it. Any drug, you name it. The greatest drug problem we got today is alcoholism. Alcohol is a drug. Sometimes we say, well, here we have all these drugs and we list them, plus alcoholism. That's not right. Alcoholism is a drug. Now, it may surprise you to hear that all of us in this room, every one of us, are affected by alcoholism in one way or another. Maybe by your mother, your father, brother, sister, husband, wife, grandma, grandpa, I don't care who it is, we're affected one way or another in this problem of alcoholism. If no other way, you might be run into head-on in your car with a guy or a woman who's drunk. So we're all affected one way or another by alcoholism. No one is excused. And we hear so much about drugs today. But don't forget alcoholism, the greatest drug problem, and I call it a problem, in America. Now, to see the scope of this kind of a drug problem, listen to this. This leads all kinds of people, into the greatest mental problems that America knows today. 62% of every person in a hospital today, whether it's a mental or any other kind of a hospital, is there because of alcoholism. Just think of that. There are 100 million people, think of that too, in the United States where alcoholism affects them one way or another. 100 million of us in America. One out of every 5 of these people become alcoholics or are problem drinkers. 1 out of every 5 of those who use alcohol in any manner, shape, or form, if it's just social drinking or what it is. 60% of the arrests made today by any police officer is due to alcoholism. 60%. Now, this covers a gamut from a 14-year-old kid way up to a grandpa. It makes no difference. I'm from California, and I'm sorry to bring you this kind of a statistic from my own state, but this is true. In California, we have $1 billion a year that is spent on alcoholism. A billion, not a million, but $1 billion a year. Now, this is much more than all the money spent in the 9 campuses of our University of California. Because on the 9 campuses, we spend $300 million. $300 million on the 9 campuses. But we spend $1 billion on alcoholism. And I suppose you all know that San Francisco is the most wicked city in America. They have 3 times as much alcoholism, 3 times as much rape, 3 times as much dope, 3 times as much sex offense, you name it, San Francisco's got it. 3 times more than any city in America. Well, that's my home state. Now, if we treated alcoholism on a 1-to-1 basis, say if a doctor had 1 alcoholic, and then another doctor had another alcoholic, and we treated them on a 1-to-1 basis, every doctor in America wouldn't have anything else to do, and every bed in every hospital would have an alcoholic person in it. Just think of that. That's part of the scope of alcoholism today, 1900 and 75. No health problem has been so seriously neglected as alcoholism. We say we've conquered TB, we've conquered polio, we've conquered all the rest of this. But we haven't even begun to stop to do anything with alcoholism. Oh yeah, we talk about some preventative measures and so forth, but as we go on here, there are very, very little. In fact, today, there are many, many doctors who will not touch an alcoholic case. They don't even want to get in the problem. Say nothing about pastors. I know a lot of my colleagues who don't want a thing to do with alcoholism, even within their congregation, because it's a pretty discouraging thing to work with. There's enough discouraging things to work with, but to work with an alcoholic, that can be the most discouraging thing in the world. But when the breakthrough comes, it can be the most encouraging thing. And I've had the privilege of dealing with both. There's Greg Toynbee, a great sociologist, psychologist, has stated that alcoholism today is the greatest national hazard we have in the world, not just America. He calls racism, nuclear warfare, and alcoholism the big three. Alcoholism, nuclear warfare, and racism. The big three in the world today. And America leads the way in alcoholism. Another tragic condition is that alcoholism is on a great increase among the women of America. Mothers, wives, prospective mothers, prospective wives. There isn't anything that hurts me more than to come in a home and see a lone woman drinker, where she just sucks the bottle all day long and doesn't do anything else. And I run into that too. Maybe you know of some of these conditions. From 1950 to 1964, women alcoholism increased 150% in America. Now that's 64. Now it's much, much more. I don't have the latest figure. But between those 14 years, 150%, and now, of course, much more, because since 1964, 11 years ago, social drinking has become the order of the day. If I, today, now it didn't used to be like this. When I first came in the ministry, anybody who had a bottle or was drinking, boy, when the preacher came around, everything was ducked under the table. I remember coming to home one time where the women were playing bridge, and they had little glasses on their table, you know. And I snuck in the back way because I knew this lady very well, so I snuck in the back door. And boy, when I came through the kitchen and back, those glasses went under the table, you know. And I said, ladies, don't push those glasses under the table. I'm sure what you're drinking is perfectly okay. But I sat down with one of them and I said, I'd like to take a smell of this. Pure alcohol. And I suppose 8 of those 12 women there that day were members of the congregation I served. Well, of course, well, they didn't like the preacher to get, they didn't want me to know that. But I knew it, and they knew it. And this got me much closer to those ladies than anything else I could have done. But today, I don't go in a home. What people say, well, you want a drink before supper? You want a drink before we eat? How about a drink? It's kind of a warm day. How about a drink? Because I'm a preacher, that doesn't make sense. And it shouldn't. It shouldn't. But it's all over the place today. It's set before you any place that you go. Now, let us not forget that alcoholism is a disease, as much of a disease as tuberculosis, polio, cancer, you name it. Alcoholism is a disease. It's nothing else. And as we discuss what alcoholism is here, you're going to discover that it's the greatest disease that a human being can have. Some have broken down the problem by denominations in the church. And that's kind of interesting. Some of my Catholic friends, Catholic priests, I suppose that's been on the increase for so long, and I suppose their church structure has helped this thing along. So the Roman Catholic Church today has more treatment centers all over America than any other church denomination. Treatment for alcoholism, even among their priesthood. Yeah. Problem. The Lutherans, well, we aren't so hot either. We'd have nothing to write home about that we can say our nose is clean either. Presbyterians, Baptists, the whole bunch. I come from Norwegian stock. And again, sorry to say that Northern Europe is a great drinking place. And of course, we say, well, it's a blame cold up there. They have to do something to keep warm on the inside. So they drink. Northern Europe are heavy drinkers. And of course, that's where my ancestors came from. Maybe some of yours. Yeah.
Isn't that a false thing though? I mean,
isn't that what?
People thinking that drinking one's
that
doesn't really work,
does
it? No.
That's very much.
I mean, I think it feels that way, but it's really deceptive, and sometimes it can't.
Well, you take a drunk. I remember in my hometown, Southern Wisconsin, there was a fellow there who was a town drunk. He was always drunk, and it got cold in Southern Wisconsin. But this guy never froze. He was so full of booze that alcoholism doesn't freeze. You put alcohol in the radiator of your car, you know, to keep it from freezing. And he was so full of booze, he laid out in the snow, he never froze. So I suppose that's part of it. I don't know if it keeps you warm or not, but that's part of it. Okay. An alcoholic person is powerless over alcohol. An alcoholic person is powerless over alcohol. You take a diabetic person. If it's gone too far, they're powerless too, we say, until they start taking insulin and all that. But alcoholism is 100 times worse. Now today we could go into the history of alcoholism. We could go into the nature of the problem. We could go into the diagnosis of it. We could go into the treatment of it, all this, but we just don't have time for all this. So I'm not going to go into any of this today, but we are going to do something else. We're going to use our time to try to do all we can on a preventative level to at least prevent those who haven't started that they never start. And I think we have to start with that preventative measure, because the other problem is too huge for any of us. So the first night we were on ship, Jen was kind of tired, and she stayed in the stateroom, and I said, I'm going to go for a walk. So I was gone for about 2 hours, you know, and when I came back, she was really excited. She said, where in the world have you been? Well, I said, let's go to sleep now. I'll tell you tomorrow. Jen's pretty inquisitive, you know. So I said, okay, I'll tell you where I was. I was up in the bar, but let's leave it at that, and then we'll talk about it tomorrow. So this is what I did. I went to that bar the first night, and I went up to the bar and put my foot on the railing and leaned on the bar. And the bartender says, good evening, chaplain. What'll you have to drink tonight? I says, do you have a nice cold glass of milk? He says, I sure do. I said, okay, I'll take one. So he put this glass of milk on the bar, and I stood by the bar drinking his milk. Of course, everybody could tell it was milk, you know, because it was a different color than liquor. And so I started visiting and with different people there. And pretty soon somebody said, well, come on, sit down. So I went down, sat at a table, and I was drinking my milk. They were drinking their liquors. And pretty soon they were dancing around and everything and drinking. And pretty soon the conversation started going around to the service I had, you know, on all this business. And what church were you with? All this. Well, this was real interesting. So I spent 2 hours there. And the next night I says, Jen, you're going to the bar with me tonight. Oh, she says, you think so? Yeah, I said, that's fine. So we went in the bar, and when the bartender saw us come in, he put 2 glasses of milk on the bar. And we walked up, and I laughed. I said, yeah, my wife likes milk too. And so we had a good time with this, see. And we were there every night, because that's where the people congregated. And we were with the people, we sat down at the tables with them. And you know, the last night we were aboard ship, we were there 12 nights. We had 20-some people around that big table. And the thing I noticed was that only 2 people were drinking hard liquor. And I never said 1 word about drinking. But only 2 people were drinking hard liquor. Example? It's there if you have guts enough to be that kind of a Christian. And it takes courage. But remember, the Lord said, with me, all things are possible. It wasn't me that did it. It was the Lord. Okay, that's my confession. Now I'm going to recommend 3 books for your library that you can either buy or that you can read here. Because all 3 of these books are from your library here at Holden. And I went down there today to try to find what they had. And you got some good books here. And the interesting thing is, I know the author of 2 of them. Howard Kleinbell is a good friend of mine. He's a Methodist from Los Angeles. And I used him for training sessions up in the Bay Area. And this one, John Keller, he's an ALC pastor who is now in the Lutheran General Hospital in Chicago, Illinois, one of the great rehabilitation center for alcoholics. And John is an authority on alcoholism, believe me, and he's a good boy. And both these guys I know, this one I don't know, Jerry Dunn, I don't know him, but this is a good book. God is for the Alcoholic. This one, Ministering to Alcoholics, this Understanding and Counseling the Alcoholic. These 3 books. And I'll have them up here. You have them all in your library. Now, I'm going to read a couple things out of a couple of these books that I think you should know. I'm going to start with this one to kind of whet your appetite. Here's a picture of Jerry Dunn. And here's what he says. God is for the alcoholic. I discovered this for myself at the conclusion of a 2-year drunk when I picked up a Bible in a Texas prison more than 16 years ago. I have seen it proved over and over again in the lives of men and women in every strata of society. There is hope for the alcoholic and his bewildered, suffering family. And this is done. And this is a dandy book, and I'm sure that you'd get a lot of help by looking it over. Now, on this book here, Understanding the Alcoholic, here we have a real good book, and I'm going to give you some things from this book regarding the Alcoholic Anonymous group. And they're a great group. Maybe we won't get into the prevention angle of it today. But I'm going to give you something now that I wish you'd write down. If you don't have anything else to write on the back of this. So there's some blank pages there. Entitle this, are you an alcoholic? And then I'm going to give you a bunch of questions that you find in this book. Now, if you want to get this from the book, fine. I'll read them quite fast, so in case if you want to get it from the book, that's better. One, do you lose time from your work due to drinking? Two, is drinking making your home life unhappy? Three, do you drink because you're shy with other people? Four, is drinking affecting your reputation? Have you ever felt remorse over drinking? Six, have you gotten into financial difficulties? Seven, do you turn to lower companions? Eight, does your drinking make you careless with your life? Does your ambition decrease since drinking? Do you crave a drink at a definite time daily? And then he goes on with these specific questions. And I would say it'd be good for every one of us to go over this list if you have ever had a drink. One drink. If you've ever had a drink, go over it.
Yeah. I can't get you shorthand, so you'll have to put that out where we can get it.
Sure, I'll put them out here, and these books are in the library. Please take down the authors, though, and the book, will you? Now, this is Howard Kleinbell. That's Kleinbell. Understanding and Counseling the Alcoholic. That's one book. This one, God is for the Alcoholic, by Jerry Dunn, Dunn. And then this one by John Keller, Ministering to the Alcoholics, by John Keller, capital Kelleer. Those are the three that you have in your library right here. Now I'd like to get into something else for just a minute. I'm going to take you on seven steps downhill from the first drink and down. Just seven of them. The first one usually starts with social drinking. Usually. A person just going to go down and buy a bottle of liquor and go home and take a drink for the first time alone. But you usually get it at a kind of a social function. And then there are a lot of people that drink socially for months and even years, and seemingly doesn't affect them. The second step down is dependent drinking. When you get thirsty, well, gee, I'd rather have a beer or a shot of whiskey than anything else, rather than a glass of water, see. Dependent drinking. Third, the pre-alcoholic phase, P-H-A-S-E, the pre-alcoholic phase. You see, this isn't very far from the social drinker to the pre-alcoholic phase. This is the place where you gulp your liquor. You don't sip it, but you gulp it like a glass of water. That's your pre-alcoholic. Or where you might sneak a drink, see? You might sneak it. Or you might be at a party and you want to be a big shot, so you want to be the bartender. And you say, the drinks are on the house. I'll give them to you. I'll buy the whole bunch of your drink. That's pre-alcoholic phase, if you act that way, see. Then four, you get right into the problem drinking. And when I say problem, that goes into various phases with your family, your spouse, your children, yourself, you don't feel good, your stomach's burned up because of alcoholism, maybe your liver is affected, and that's when your problems start. Then the fifth one, you drop over into alcoholism. Now you don't go into alcoholism, you drop over. It's that simple. Your life at that point is no more normal as you've known a normal life. It's no more normal. The sixth one is chronic alcoholism. And this affects everything. You're always out of work. Maybe you can hold a job for a little while, but pretty soon you're fired. And you go from one job to another. And you go from one strata of living to another strata. You drink up your home. You drink up your income. You drink up your clothes. Your clothes. You don't care what you look like anymore. You don't shave if you shave. You don't do anything. You just don't care. That's the chronic alcoholic. And then, of course, the seventh one is organic deterioration. And our bodies are all made up of organs. That's the last one. Here, your body really takes a beating. Now, to get up from that stage to normal living again, boy, that takes some doing. How do you check yourself or a loved one on these phases? Take them down and talk to your loved one, or talk to yourself, or if any of you are troubled with alcoholism or with drinking of any kind, I'm going to be around you for 2 weeks. You can talk to me anytime. I'll be glad to talk to you. Not that maybe I can help you, but at least you can get it off your chest, and maybe the Lord will use some way that we can help you. Then we come to the question, why do people drink? Why? And here we could go into a whole gamut of things.
I think one of the major troubles is social pressure. Now, at the place where I work, the University of Idaho, the students have, I think, a ferocious alcohol problem. It's pretty bad. But the thing is, among so many of our students, to get drunk is a symbol of prestige. I eat with the students, and so many of them just brag about the drinking they do. And that's all they talk about. I hate to say it, but I think in the University of Idaho, anyway, there's a good part of the student population whose great ambition in life, which is indicated by the way they talk when I eat with them, is to get drunk.
All right. We drink for social prestige. That's one of them now. Why do we drink? Another reason why you can drink has something to do with your body makeup. And we're going to get into that tomorrow. That takes a little while. But why do we drink? Maybe a husband and wife can't get along, so they have to have an outlet. You want to forget something, so you get high, and then you forget, see? But then you wake up next morning with a headache, and then you remember everything, much to your chagrin. So we need to work on this thing of prevention. We're going to go into this a little bit more about why people drink tomorrow. And then tomorrow, too, because our time is almost up here now, I want to get in on the actual prevention. But before we leave today, I want to tell you a story which goes to show, I think, how far alcoholism can go in a person. Some years ago, there was a fellow that was constantly coming to my office, and he was always drunk, and he always wanted me to help him. And there wasn't a thing I could do because he's always drunk. And once in a while he'd be a little sober, and I'd tell him, Joe, I can't do a thing for you. You're always drunk. And you come to me and you cry and you want to help. And the poor guy was so sick, you know, just so sick. And I'd take him to a hospital and dry him out, you know. And then he'd be a little better for a little while, but that didn't do any good. And so one day I told him, I really got tough with him. I said, Joe, I don't want to see you in my office anymore. I said, I'm going to write you off. You're just no good. God loves you, but to me you're no good. You just waste my time. I can't help you. Well, I says, Joe, now there's a door, don't ever come back. Because I can't do a thing, you don't want to help yourself, nobody want, you don't want any help. Well, about 2 days later, I saw Joe come walking up thing again. And he's walking pretty straight that day. And he came in, Pastor, can I talk to you? Yeah, you seem pretty good today, Joe, come on in. So, as I saw him come walking, I got two glasses and put them on my desk. And then I run out the back door and I did something else, which I'll tell you about. And when Joe came in, he looked at those two glasses. And I said right away to him, I said, Joe, do you have that flask on your hip again today? Oh, yeah, yeah. Gee, it just fit right around there, you know. And he says, I see you're going to drink with me today. No, Joe, I said, I'm going to perform an experiment for you. Oh, yeah. Well, I says, will you take that flask out? I said, and put it on my desk here. So he did. Pure alcohol. Pure alcohol. That's what he drank. I says, now, there's a faucet over there in that sink, and I'm going to have you do this. Would you take one glass and go and fill it with that water? So he did, and came back, put it on. I said, now I'm going to write water here so that we don't forget that that's water. And I put a piece of paper under the water. I said, will you take this other glass and will you fill it with your bottle? So he did. I said, okay, now let's put alcohol on that. And I said, now these two look just alike, don't they? Yeah? Yeah, look just alike. What about it? Well, I says, now, have you ever seen anything like this before? And I held up my hand and I had an angleworm in it. Well, yeah, he said, that's an angleworm. Well, I said, now, Joe, will you take that and will you drop that angleworm in this glass here that says water? So Joe did. And the angleworm swam around and there, you know. And he says, so what? Well, I says, you see, it's perfectly okay. It likes it there, doesn't it? But now, I says, Joe, will you take that angleworm out of there and will you drop it into the other glass? So he did. And that thing straightened out like a pencil, you know. As soon as it hit the alcoholism, it was as stiff as that pencil. And he looked at it. It didn't move. He said, what happened? I said, alcohol killed that angleworm. He says, it's dead? Yeah. I said, now, will you take it out of there and will you go like this? So he took it out. I said, now, will you bend it? He bent it, it cracked just like if I'd cracked this pencil. Now, I says, Joe, this is a little experiment I want to show you. I says, you and I, our body is a little bit stronger than that of an angleworm. But I says, little by little, you're killing yourself. You're killing yourself as sure as if you'd go out here with a gun and shoot yourself. And boy, this really shocked Joe. He just sat there and looked at that worm, you know, that was broken in half. I said, now, Joe, maybe we'll get someplace today. Would you take this glass and would you take the rest of that bottle and would you go and pour it down the toilet? Yeah, yeah. So he did. He says, so what? I said, now in your room, I said, I imagine you have a lot of other bottles, don't you? Oh, yeah. Well, I said, will you go home to your room and will you bring all your bottles to my office? Well, what are we going to do? I said, we're going to pour them down my toilet because it needs cleaning up. And you're going to do it. If you mean that you're going to quit drinking, you've got to show me because I'm from Missouri. You've got to show me. So Joe went and boy, he came back with two big boxes, you know, full of alcohol. And boy, some, a lot of money, you know. And Joe opened them and I said, okay, now you open all those bottles and you start pouring. I said, you're going to do this, I'm not. So, very reluctant, he said, well, these cost money, can't we sell them? No, I said, then somebody else will get them. I said, nobody will get them down that drain. So very reluctantly, he did this, you know. And when we got through with those two boxes, I says, now, is that all the liquor you have in your room? Well, he says, Pastor, I have to be honest with you. I got some more. I said, will you go and clean out your room then and bring it all here? I says, can you make it in two more boxes? No, he says, I don't think so. I said, okay, I'll go with you. And I went with him, and we brought back three big boxes, and we had it all. Joe opened them all, poured it down, and I flushed the whole thing, and of course, the toilet worked great. That was the end of Joe's drinking. He came to this decision, I'm not going to do it. I tried everything on him, prayer and everything else, but the shock, I think, shocked him into something. Now, that was 8 years ago. Joe hasn't touched a drop since. I got him in touch with AA, and boy, he's as faithful as can be. He's been on the wagon since. He's married. He has two fine children, a real good job, and Joe is a real good friend of mine. Class over. We'll meet tomorrow.